Our first reading today is from the Reverend Meg Barnhouse, who was our guest here with us last October. As we begin our reflection on times we resist the various calls to life, we could do quite worse than to begin with the insight mixed with Meg's particular brand of humor. Here is her piece entitled, Unblinking Witness.
On the carport side of my house are two blue spots. The rest of the house is a deep purple gray. The spots mark the place where my ladder rested while I was doing the last bit of painting. I told myself I would let the paint dry and take care of the spots. It has been a year and a half. I know the paint is dry now. But I have some resistance to finishing. I want to figure out why this is. Finishing would be depressing. I would then have to start scraping, sanding, and painting the trim. When one job is finished, it is time for the next job. Maybe not finishing is a way of resting. That's part of it. I have no resistance to finishing writing jobs. I finish songs and sermons with ease. Cleaning jobs, now those I don't like to finish. I like leaving one dish still in the sink or out on the counter. It feels like a lie to pretend to finish a job like that. We all know dishwashing, cleaning, painting, any kind of maintenance is never really finished. Why not just make peace with the fact that I am fighting chaos constantly? Why do people pretend they finish things like that? Why not leave a little chaos on purpose so I can let the universe know I get the joke? That way, I can feel I have some control in the unfinished nature of the situation. Yeah, that's it. I remember looking at myself in the mirror, brushing my teeth. I must have been 12 or 13. It struck me that I was going to have to brush my teeth at least once a day until I died. Thousands of times. I was outraged. The two spots of blue on my house feel like rebellion. They say, I know this job isn't finished. And it's never going to be. Raking leaves, brushing teeth, washing dishes. They have to be done over and over. Finishing is an illusion. And I know it. You haven't fooled me into acting as if I'm through, even for a minute. Maybe I have to learn my steps in the dance of ongoing process. I talk a good game about letting go of control, acknowledging that the journey is the teacher, not the goal. But the two blue spots on the side of the house are a mute and unblinking witness to the fact that I still fight. I want to be able to do all the housework my house will ever need and then never do housework again. I would love to do a week of constant exercise and never have to do it again. I can think of ongoing processes I love. Writing, eating, talking, making love, gardening, watching movies, reading. I don't have any outrage about not being able to do at one time all the eating I will ever need to do. Thinking about making all the love I will ever need at one time just makes me laugh. Can I learn to love the process of cleaning? Can I learn to think of painting as a pleasant pastime? It looks like too much of a stretch right now. I'm going to leave that resistant, rebellious part of myself unfinished too. I'm going to leave a few unpainted, unimproved spots on my character to match my house.
Well, our next reading is a poem about a man who resists the call to put a particular expression of faith at the center of his life. There is a more universal message here as well. Jack Gilbert's cautionary poem, Refusing Heaven.
The old women in black at early mass in winter are a problem for him. He could tell by their eyes they have seen Christ. They make the kernel of his being and the clarity around it seem meager, as though he needs girders to hold up his unusable soul. But he chooses against the Lord. He will not abandon his life, not his childhood, not the 92 bridges across the two rivers of his youth, nor the mills along the banks where he became a young man as he worked. The mills are eaten away and eaten again by the sun and its rusting. He needs them, even though they are gone, to measure against. The silver is worn down to the brass underneath and is the better for it. He will gauge by the smell of concrete sidewalks after night rain. He is like an old ferry dragged onto the shore, a home in its smashed grandeur with giant beams and joists, like a wooden ocean out of control. A beached heart, a cauldron of cooling melt.
Thank you, Nathan. Thank you. Irony can be a terrible thing. Especially on Monday morning. This last Monday, after a wonderful, surprisingly wonderful, but not really, I knew it would be good, experience at Columbus's annual Martin Luther King Memorial Breakfast with at least 50 other members and friends of this congregation, many of whom were singing very loud and beautifully in the choir, and about 3,000 of our other friends. At the very end, they showed on four big screens, maybe more, Will.i.am's from the hip-hop group Black Eyed Peas song for Barack Obama's campaign, Yes, We Can. And it interspersed snippets of Obama's campaign speeches and people singing in dialogue. I had seen this on YouTube, and I liked it then. Up on the big screen, I was moved. I'm a child of the television age. Big screens work for me. Yes, we can. Yes, we can. Yes, we can. And then I remembered my preparation for our time this morning, for this reflection. And I was humbled. That's where the irony comes in. This is our month of reflecting on resistance. And the story I have to tell you is a story of my own resistance. There's this little word, we say it every Sunday. The word is transformed. In our opening unison reading, we say, may we ourselves remain opened by being transformed by a welcoming heart. Confession time, friends. For years, I have held my heart closed from many, perhaps not all, experiences of transformation. I kept it held tight because of grief. And now, it should be a little easier than it was in our earlier service because of the snow. Look out and see, if you can hear, the snow on the pine trees. And imagine Vancouver, Canada, close to where our story came from that Mark so miraculously told, experienced, embodied earlier. Thank you, Mark. This comes from July of 1999, my first time ever in Vancouver. My then wife, Jennifer, a musician who spent her summers doing music camps around the nation. As a minister, summer was my only time off, and it was her time to go and do the work. It was the only time she had to do that. So I would never see my wife all summer long. And I got a little tired of that. And I said, Jennifer, once this summer, I want to join you. And she said, well, I'll be in Amherst, I'll be in Boston, I'll be in Chicago, and I'll be in Vancouver. Take your pick. Vancouver. And I got there, and she said, now, I'm going to be busy. You've got a couple of days to see the sights. What you really want to do, Eric, is go to this one particular museum. I was like, I've got 2 days. I've been cooped up inside all year round. I've got Stanley Park. I've got the Granville Public Market. I've got the ferry that will take me out to Mount Whistler. Museums are great, but I don't have time. She said, make time. I don't know about you, but I hate it when other people know me better than myself. Because a few miles west of downtown Vancouver is one of the wonders of the world in the form of the University of British Columbia's Museum of Anthropology. As far as I can tell, it sits on the bluff overlooking a bay to the east or north and a bay to the west. Victoria Island is off to the west. It's just gorgeous. And it looks, as far as I can tell, that the museum itself is settled on what had been, probably during the Second World War, an anti-aircraft defense institution. There are a number of heavy, concrete, cylindrical things, and I was really into big guns as a kid, and it looks exactly like the foundations for anti-aircraft guns I've seen. And if you go inside the museum, you find one of those large turrets inside, under a sun lamp. Sunlight. One of those things. Like that. And on that, if you see in your program, we've got a little sketch of Raven and the Clam and the First People. Picture this in sun-drenched yellow cedar, 8 feet to a side. The wood glows. There's no other word for it. I was transfixed. I hadn't known the story. Here was Raven, the trickster like Coyote in the Southwest, easing those people out. He wanted to be entertained. He wanted to make trouble. But it's that urging in the Haida people's myth that brought us people out of animal consciousness into the human condition. And like perhaps, oh, I don't know, maybe all of you, there's a part of me that holds my fears very close. I could identify with those little people in the clam. I didn't want to come out into the dangerous world. I wanted to stay safe. And so I just stood there saying, oh my God, she was right. Thank God I'm married to Jennifer. Within a month, though, a very short month, it was clear that the marriage was on the rocks and Jennifer was leaving. I went back to that image of those huddled, scared little people because being on my own was terribly scary. I really wanted to go back now. Serving my congregation, taking care of a wife who was dealing with difficult, deep depression during the time of her decision-making process, I barely had any time or energy to take care of myself. I was a basket case, and that's not an exaggeration. But I knew that by opening up to grief, I would move through it. And I told myself, all right, Eric, you are going to grieve. You are going to wallow in this if that's what it takes for a year. And then you're going to bounce back because that's what you do. I was raised a humanist in the Unitarian tradition, Unitarian Universalist tradition. It's taken me a long time to be comfortable with this phrase, but I was not respecting God's time. 1 year was my time. It was not God's time for me. That poem we read, that Mark so well read, about the man whose soul needed to be girded up, that was me. That was me. I remember a Sunday not too long after the divorce was announced to the congregation when I thought I had the gumption to talk about how men and women can get along a little better. Someone got it. And it was a woman by the name of Dee Wood, who was our almost equal to Doug there, our choir director, who said, "Eric, are you sure this is something you can do?" Ding! I have no idea what I shared with the congregation that day. My apologies still go out to them. It was not ministry. For years, I was the man in that poem. Going back, holding on to the experience that made me what I wasn't able to take perhaps a leap of faith. Oh, something I forgot. At that year marker, I knew I wasn't done with grief, but I was tired of grief. Maybe you have a similar time in your life. And I remember a moment I made a very conscious decision. And I was like, no, I'm going to stop for a while. And I could feel in that moment, in that decision, my heart close a little bit. It took years, 3, 4, 5, 6, before I was able to feel my heart open a little bit. There's a response to the man in that poem by one of our pioneer Unitarian ministers, William Ellery Channing. It's not long. I'd like to read it to you now. "We apprehend that it is possible to make experience too much our guide. There are seasons in human affairs of inward and outward revolution when new depths seem to be broken up in the soul, when new wants are unfolded in multitudes, and new and undefined good is thirsted for. These are periods when the principles of experience need to be modified, when hope and trust and instinct claim a share with prudence in the guidance of our affairs. When, in truth, to dare is the greatest wisdom. When to dare may be the greatest wisdom." In my case, daring meant taking in a little more of my grief, opening my heart so that I would be moved through it instead of stopping it prematurely. I also remember one of the most helpful things that got me through. And a friend said, "Eric, take a look at your hand. My fingers are bent a little bit. I expect I'll have pretty painful arthritis before long." He said, "Think about battle scars. None of us go through life without some outward and certainly inward scarring. We try to look good, we try to present, but the truth is that life will scar us at times. And the thing we need to remember," my friend concluded, "is that it's our battle scars that make us all the more interesting. Instead of feeling shame that I was the first person in my family to be divorced, I was able to slowly say, 'Yeah, damn it, it happened to me. And I'm still standing.' It took a long time, longer than I hoped for." In closing now, I'd like to imagine you back to the land of the Haida, where it would be snowing just like this time of year. The Haida come from the Queen Charlotte Islands off the coast of British Columbia. Bill Reed, who sculpted the yellow cedar and who did the little drawing we've included in the program, and who died of Parkinson's back in 1998, wrote this of those people, his ancestors. They were no timid shell dwellers, these, but children of the wild coast, born between the sea and land, challenging the strength of the stormy North Pacific and wrestling from it a rich livelihood. For many generations, they grew and flourished, built and created, fought and destroyed, living according to the changing seasons and the unchanging rituals of their rich and complex lives. Battle-scarred, I'm sure. He concludes, "It's almost over now. Most of the villages are abandoned, and those which have not entirely vanished lie in ruins. The people there remain are changed. The sea has lost much of its emptiness, and great areas of the land itself lie in waste. Perhaps it is time for Raven to start looking for another clamshell." There are times of hardship and times of renewal. If now or at any time in the near future you find yourself wanting to jump back into Raven's clam, remember that that will only last and serve you well for a very little while, if at all. The secret of being human is jumping out, finding your mates, daring to make experience only so much our guide, holding your heart even as it bleeds, and taking the next leap of faith. Thank you. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Jim Pinkham, and before we give and receive our offering this morning on this beautiful, beautiful snowy morning, I'd like to share something special with you. It's an opportunity to make connections with each other in a fun way that I'm kind of enthusiastic about because it's so in sync with everything I really love about our community here. I'm talking about our upcoming auction, Saturday, February 21st at 6 p.m. It's a great social event, good food, friends, and over-the-top decorations. But then, for the rest of the year, we make all kinds of surprising and wonderful connections with each other as we attend all the events we've signed up for. I've enjoyed so many of these. Sublime dinners, of course, but also nature walks, silly games night, all kinds of things. I remember Wendy Fish signed up for a motorcycle ride that I offered, and it literally made her squeal with glee on the back of the motorcycle. It was great. It was so much fun. We have such a wealth of creativity here, and that's the first opportunity I'd like to share with you. Will you make something of it with your participation? Mark your calendars for Saturday, February 21st at 6 p.m. Stop by the auction table today. You could bring food, or we really need those donation descriptions now so we can have the catalog ready in about 2 weeks. So that's coming right up. We have volunteer opportunities to reward every level of involvement. So ask us about those, and let's do something amazing together. Opportunities are what we make of them. The strength of this community rests on the foundation of our generosity and commitment of time, enthusiasm, and treasure. The ushers will now come forward. Our offering will be taken and gratefully received. Thank you.